Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and it's time for the Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites. It's Tuesday at 10, time for a look at food, farming, and our environment. The Soundbites is a production here of the Center for Emerging Media here at WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, and also heard in DeMarva Public Radio, WSTL 90.7 FM. And you can join us here live right now at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages or tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. We joined here for the first part of our program by Tim Wheeler, reporter for Be More Green, the Baltimore Sun's environmental blog. Tim, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Mark.
So let's go through some of the things that you've been writing about. And let me let folks that know later in the program, we'll be joined by Jacqueline Patterson, who is director of the NAACP's Climate Justice Initiative, and Brent Mock, both who took part in Mississippi Freedom Summer, talking about the connection between environmental justice, race, and voting rights, and more. So stay with us for that portion of this program. But Tim, I was really interested in reading your pieces that you wrote about and the Sun Investigates around phosphorus. It's a huge hot debate here, and I think people. Now, we've talked about this in terms of the phosphorus management tool and that it was not put in place when it was supposed to be put in place, was delayed. But the issue of phosphorus and nitrogen in our waterways is much more serious than I think we're realizing, and you were trying to point that out, I think, in this article.
Yeah, Mark, it was somewhat, interesting to see. We get a lot of reports, report cards and whatever on progress in the bay restoration, and sometimes we sort of need to step back and take stock of things, and on the whole, since the mid 80s, it appears that there has been some progress. That's 30 years of work. You would hope you would see some, but I guess what sort of drew my attention was that when they began to sort of break this out and look at recent trends within the last decade, there was a somewhat troubling phenomenon that was showing up. While nitrogen levels appeared to be, and these were measurements, actually. This is not just measuring paper progress of various government programs. These were samples taken from rivers and streams around the Bay region by the U.S. Geological Survey. They're from their stream gauges. They were showing that the nitrogen levels were falling in most of the stream gauges that they were measuring. But phosphorus in the last decade appeared to have leveled off, and in some rivers was actually going up again. And that was a little disturbing because we've, ostensibly stepped up the effort on restoring the bay in the last several years. So it was revealing, and the places where it was the phosphorus was sort of trending in the wrong direction tended to be in areas that were predominantly agricultural. But there were also some urban and suburban areas too. So that the two trouble spots, I guess, no big surprise if you followed the Bay Restoration, were agricultural runoff and stormwater runoff.
But it seems while there's been advancement, and I think the Chesapeake Bay agreements in the past have kind of forced the issue along with the EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, forcing the issue in tougher ways. We don't know what's going to be in this next agreement. It's going to be signed on Monday with the Chesapeake Bay Agreement. We'll find out about that on Monday and talk about that next Tuesday. But with the phosphorus management tool being put off, which is supposed to be the way to measure what really comes off of farms and be able to locate and pinpoint where phosphorus is coming from farms into our riverways, when what people call the rain tax is kind of whittled down to nothing by most localities in Maryland, and to kind of try to address at least in terms of the fixing up the bay from all the runoff from suburban urban areas, which we're not addressing at all in any kind of meaningful way in terms of stopping it. There's reasons why this is happening. And it seems like in some ways it's happening and we're really doing, I wouldn't say very little about it, but we're doing less about it than could be done.
Well, what we're facing here is a challenge, is that we keep adding people to the region. You're paddling upstream, if you will. So they have to try harder. I mean, that was the whole point of the pollution diet, or the TMDL, that total maximum daily load regulation that limits that the Environmental Protection Agency put on the Bay States, was basically to sort of force the issue, to push them farther. They're making efforts. There was a recent evaluation I wrote about from the Environmental Protection Agency of how the states were doing. In you know, good cheerleader fashion, EPA had lots of nice things to say about the states, but when you read all the documents, you found that they found basically shortcomings across the board, everywhere, including in Maryland. Though Maryland perhaps fared better than some of our neighboring states, EPA was harshest, I suppose, on Pennsylvania, where they found that they were doing nowhere near enough in terms of agriculture or in terms of their urban runoff. Maryland fell short on the phosphorus management tool, for sure. That was something that had been promised years ago. It was essentially completed over a year ago, and yet the state has had real difficulty bringing itself to adopt it because of resistance from the agricultural community, from the poultry industry in particular.
I mean, when you write in your piece, one of the things, these two lines you have in here, one is poultry industry supporters argue that chicken manure is not responsible for rising phosphorus levels. They note that the number of chickens raised in Delmarva has declined in recent years, and the birds. But another report, you say the Bay Program concluded phosphorus produced by chicken flocks raised in Maryland has increased. It suggests the birds have been raised are larger, producing more waste, and the waste remains in chicken houses longer before cleaned out, increasing concentration. So what's the reality?
Well, it's they're still trying to sort that out. You know, I attempted to get some reaction from the Poultry Industry Association of Delmarva Poultry Industry, and they said they had not seen this report, which had been out for over a month now from both at the Bay Program. They delivered it at one of their many meetings down there in Annapolis. So these were essentially working hypotheses from the from the Environmental Protection Agency, based on what information they had. The number of birds fewer, apparently, reported to be fewer, but appear that at least some of the birds are larger, and therefore they may be actually generating more waste, and that's offsetting some of the other things, you know, the other positive trends that are out there. Part of the, you know, the leveling off in or lack of progress seen in the last decade, some think that there may be a sort of a lag time here, that you know, all the pollution that's flowed into the bay, because it is a sort of essentially a big bowl with only a narrow opening at the end, doesn't get flushed out readily, and it takes a while. But certainly there are signs that in some, you know, streams and rivers, 16% of them, the phosphorus levels are actually going up. That's the wrong direction, and so something still is being added to the mix there.
It's, so, I mean, because then it kind of fits right into what you were writing another piece a little bit later about the rise, the dead zones in the Chesapeake Bay getting even bigger.
Well, yeah, that's a short term phenomenon. Every summer, the scientists go out and they assess the levels of phosphorus and nitrogen and sediment in the water. They look at the weather conditions and how much rainfall or snow happened. And they make predictions on the size of the dead zone. And this year it looks like it's going to be, you know, at least for much of the summer, a little bit above average. That doesn't sound so terrible, but average is pretty bad. you know, that's not necessarily a good thing. The hopeful sign in a way is that we've had a lot of rain this spring, so maybe that's better. But, you know, you can get sort of hung up on those short-term predictions and measurements like that. The weather's going to impact these things every year, and the weather, as we know, is never the same from one day or one year to the next. The longer-term issues like the measurements that the U.S. Geological Survey piles up year after year after year give you a sort of a sure sense of whether you're making progress. Progress seems to be not going quite as well as hoped for, at least in terms of phosphorus. Nitrogen seems to be still making progress.
So finally, I just want to ask you this piece that you wrote about the pesticides found in this the garden store plants that were bee-friendly plants. And you know, one of the things that people have noted, I've talked to some people who follow bees around, that they're seeing fewer and fewer bees and butterflies in the city and around, in the surrounding metropolitan area.
Well, it's you know, there's a lot of interest in this and concern. There have been big drops noted in the managed bee colonies by beekeepers, folks who you know, keep bees to produce honey and to pollinate flowers and to pollinate agricultural crops. It's been a sort of a nationwide phenomenon, but Maryland has taken a particularly big hit. Last year's The Maryland beekeepers reported that they had lost roughly 2/3 of their hives in the, within the past year. So that's a big hit on them. And there's concern that the same thing is happening with the wild pollinators, the wild bees, you know, bumblebees and the other pollinators, including butterflies and a lot of the little ones that we don't really think about, like the sort of the sweat bee size. You see them flitting around the flowers, and they perform a vital ecological role. One of the concerns is, with the managed colonies, it's been identified that they suffer from a variety of issues. Weather can impact them, but one of the big ones is mite infestation, and a lot of the losses are blamed on that. But there are scientists and sort of a growing body of research that suggests that the use of a family of pesticides known as neonicotinoids may be a factor in weakening the bees' resistance to these other problems.
And let's know, folks, we'll be doing a segment on that in the next couple of weeks because it is an issue that people don't realize. The role the bees play in our world is not just these things you might run from, you're afraid they're going to sting you, but they actually, over 40% of all the food we consume are pollinated by bees, not just flowers. And so it's a larger issue than most people realize, and we're going to be covering some of that in the next couple of weeks to see what is happening, what we can do. Tim Wheeler, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. I want to thank you so much for joining us. The reporter for Be More Green, the Baltimore Sun Environmental Blog. I appreciate all the work you've been doing for us.
Thanks, Mark. Take care.
Take care, Tim. We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we are joined by Jacqueline Peterson, director of the NAACP's Climate Justice Initiative, and Brenton Mock, a D.C.-based journalist who writes regularly for Grist on environmental justice issues. And they were both just recently at the Mississippi Freedom Summer Conference, and we're going to talk about what they talked about there and the whole world of environmental justice, how it's tied to voting rights and racial justice in America. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Back to Mark Steiner Show here and Soundbites, and we are about to talk with Jacqueline Patterson, who is director of the NAACP Climate Justice Initiative, and Brenton Mock, Washington, D.C.-based journalist who writes regularly for Grist about environmental justice issues and connections between environmental policy, race, and politics. Jackie Peterson and Brenton Mock, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thanks for having me.
Always good to have you, Brenton. Thank you, Jacqueline. Welcome to the program. Good to have you with us. Jacqueline, there? 410-319-8888 is the number here. You can she's not there yet. Okay, I didn't see that. You can also write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner. You can call us at 410-319-8888. So on our way to waiting for Jacqueline, we'll bring some of this up when she joins us here, Brenton. I was reading the piece you wrote for Grist, and I'm glad you're writing for them. They need that kind of perspective that's been missing a little bit, I think, from their site. But we don't often make this connection between voting rights, environmental justice, and race and politics in America because we always see them as very separate issues. You know, we see them as we see voting rights as one issue and environmental justice as a separate issue, and that environmental movement is looked at as a white movement that has nothing to do with people of color. But what's being argued now very much more vociferously at last is that nothing can be further from the truth.
Yeah, I mean, you know, environment, just like any other issue in America, is affected by politics. I mean, we have elected officials who create the policy, and then they appoint the people at government agencies and departments who enforce, those policies. And you know, the environment is not immune to that. So, we need voting rights protections for all, just in the same way that we need equal protection under the law for all people, and that's really the connection that should be made.
One of the things you wrote at the top of your piece for Grist was that on the anniversary of the gutting of the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, Shelby County v. Holder, I think people don't really realize this very much. We should talk about this for a moment. Is how environmentalist labor groups and LGBTQ communities came together, as you wrote, to around the issue of voting rights and making these connections. And this is something that we don't talk about, but I think this connection is very powerful and very important.
Yeah, I mean, so after the Shelby versus Holder Supreme Court decision last summer that gutted the Voting Rights Act, I don't know if people remember. I mean, that was a really low point on the Supreme Court schedule, and as we see with the Hobby Lobby decision, they continue to disappoint us with decisions. But not long after the Shelby decision, they came down with the landmark ruling in favor of marriage equality. So, you know, that was a point in which the LGBTQ community could have said, you know, sorry, civil rights people, we got ours. Sorry if you didn't get yours. But, you know, but to their credit and, you know, and honorably, they didn't do that. They pulled together with labor groups and with environmental groups and all kinds of civil rights groups, immigration reform groups, economic justice groups, to say that, hey, you know, even though we got this favorable Supreme Court ruling, we're not going to forget this travesty that came with the Shelby versus Holder ruling. And they announced that they would do whatever they could to continue to fight for voting rights. Now, I have to say, they made that announcement shortly after the Shelby ruling. Whether there's been action on that is a different question, and that is something I did not explore in my ruling, I mean, in my article. And it's not to doubt the sincerity of LGBT groups or even environmental groups on following through with that announcement. It's just to say that, you know, if there has, in fact, been action on that, I wasn't able to present that information in my article. I can say that that there was a coalition called the Democracy Initiative that was created a little before the Shelby decision, and that was a coalition started between the NAACP, the Sierra Club, Greenpeace, and a couple other labor groups. And so there was a genuine coming together between traditional civil rights groups and environmental groups. But in terms of that post-Shelby, you know, kind of larger rainbow coalition that announced that they would come together, you know, I would love to see, you know, what the action has been on that since.
So I also want to say we've now joined also by Jacqueline Patterson. Jacqueline Patterson is director of the NAACP's Climate Justice Initiative. Jacqueline, welcome. Good to have you with us here on the Mark Steiner Show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's very good to be here.
It's great to have you with us. So talk a bit about, I want people to understand what this Climate Justice Initiative is before I ask some very specific questions at the NAACP. Could you kind of describe it for our listeners?
Sure. So the Environmental and Climate Justice Program really looks at the intersection of the fact that the very same facilities and practices that drive climate change, like coal-fired power plants, waste-burning incinerators, et cetera, are disproportionately impacting communities of color, just as the impacts of climate change also disproportionately impact both communities of color and low-income communities, whether it's the shifts in agricultural yields that make our access to healthy, nutritious foods even more difficult, or whether it's extreme weather events that also impact these communities differently because of their pre-existing vulnerabilities, whether it's the fact that these communities disproportionately have homes in the floodplains, and therefore when these flooding happens, then they're more impacted, whether it's the fact that they're underinsured, so when these disasters happen, they tend to be more unable to recover, and a myriad of other impacts of disasters. So we really look at those two sides of the coin, and we actively work towards increasing our regulatory framework so that we have better protection under the Clean Air Act, so that these communities aren't facing the level of pollution they're facing from these facilities, but then also so that we reduce the amount of carbon and methane and other greenhouse gases that go into the atmosphere. We also work on advancing the other side. So recognizing that Fossil fuel-based energy production is responsible for 40% of the greenhouse gases that drive climate change, and those same fossil fuel-based energy production processes are also polluting our communities with mercury, arsenic, lead, selenium, and a myriad other co-pollutants. Then we know that we have to not only push back on fossil fuel-based energy production, but we also have to push forward on both energy efficiency and clean energy. So our first objective is around reducing air pollution and water pollution. Our second objective is around advancing energy efficiency and clean energy. So we're pushing for energy efficiency policies and practices and clean energy policies and practices. And then our third and final objective is around strengthening community resilience so that communities are prepared for the fact that climate change is here, is impacting communities right now, and we need to be strengthening the infrastructure, systems, and programs that exist at the community level.
There's so much to get into here. Let me start with this. I'm sorry that I could not be at the Mississippi Freedom Summer Celebration and meeting that took place in Jackson at the folks at Tougaloo, but I was kept here in Baltimore. I had planned to be there. One of the reasons I wanted to go was to hear your panel that you two were on. I think you may have moderated this panel, if I'm right, Brenton. Thank you for correcting me. Rebel Smell, Voter Disenfranchisement and Environmental Injustice in the South. I love the title of that, Rebel Smell. But I talk a bit about what this connection is between voter disenfranchisement and environmental justice. And I think that because people, you know, do not, as I said earlier before we came on, Jacqueline, was that people don't often make this connection because we paint the movement around the environment in America, and whether it's about clean energy or about global climate change, what's happening to our communities or food, as a very white issue. And that's why I'm very curious how you approach it and what's happening on the ground that most people are it's remained invisible to most of the press's eye. Jacqueline, would you start us off?
Sure. So and definitely Brenton has all the credit for the title for our panel, Rebel Smell.
I'm not surprised.
Yes, it's actually based on an article that he wrote in December that he'll tell you more about. But so I'll definitely leave the time for him to describe that a little bit more. But basically, in our findings around this intersection, those very same impacts that I talked about in terms of facilities being disproportionately located in our communities, the fact that we do have this this energy landscape that's based on energy production processes that are detrimental to the health and well-being of all communities and disproportionately communities of color and low-income communities, we recognize that this is all within a political structure that where decision-making is often not made on the interests of the people or even at the behest of the people, but it is this tie between money and politics. And there is a lot of money being put into politics by the fossil fuel industry. And one of the things we talked about in our presentation was about the millions of dollars that the fossil fuel industry puts into anti-regulatory, anti-energy efficiency, anti-clean energy lobbying year after year after year. And also how even to some extent the courts are compromised by the relationship, the financial relationship with the fossil fuel industry. So whether it's the fact that we have all of these subsidies for fossil fuel-based energy production and no subsidies and very few subsidies for energy efficiency and clean energy, whether it's the fact that we have zoning boards, public utilities commissions, even rural electric co-op boards that aren't populated by communities of color and low-income communities, and the decisions that they make disproportionately impact communities of color and low-income communities, we start to see how the voter disenfranchisement issues, as it relates, whether it's people voting, people not getting to the polls to vote in the first place to get folks in the office that represent them, or people voting and the disenfranchisement comes at a different level in terms of their vote not meaning anything because the people that are elected are acting at the behest of other folks. There's a complex relationship there. And then I'll just end before moving on to Brenton by saying that another piece of voter disenfranchisement happens in that when we have these disasters, they strike harder and have a deeper impact in communities of color and low-income communities that are vulnerable. And so we see those communities where when there's rebuilding that happens, they're often redeveloped right out of their land and home. And so then when you see redistricting happening, then it tends to disenfranchise these very same communities. And so this is another kind of level of impact. So on both sides in terms of what's driving climate change and how it impacts, we see those impacts. So, thank you.
No, it's important. This is important to get these issues on the table, and we're going to be doing a great deal more of this in the coming weeks and on this program just around environmental justice. We're looking to get Dr. Robert Bullard on and others to kind of really flesh this out in a large discussion here. But I think it's important to make this happen, and there's actually a meeting taking place in Baltimore this afternoon I'm participating in, which is how to bring the environmental justice activists across the state of Maryland together to become a force of the environmental movement, also the entire community. So I think this is an issue that whose time has come. I think we have about another 2 minutes. Brenton, you want to start us off with what you about this rebel smell and where it came from, and then let you finish after break.
Yeah, well, the rebel smell, I mean, that article was based off a report that Jackie did. I mean, that was the report that she helped put together for the NAACP that basically reviewed the both the fossil fuel preponderance in all of the states, and also the emerging clean energy markets in all of the states. And one quick thing, I mean, one thing that her research showed was that when you looked at the states that had the most saturated fossil fuel industries, and also the least stringent renewable energy policies, they all happen to be the former Confederate states, right, which happened to be the same states that were covered by Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which was gutted by the Supreme Court. So my article was just about connecting the dots between the fact that the states that had the most fossil fuel plants and the least clean energy policies just happened to be the same states that not only have majority African, you know, huge African-American populations concentrated there, but also where their voting rights are most vulnerable because of the gutting of the Voting Rights Act.
We're going to take a very brief break and come right back with our two guests, Brenton Mock, who independent journalist based in Washington, does a lot of writing for Grist around environmental justice, and Jacqueline Patterson, who is director of the NAACP's Climate Justice Initiative. Stay with us and join us with your thoughts on this, 410-319-8888. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show on Soundbites, CNWEAA 88.9 FM. We are here with Jacqueline Patterson, who is director of the NAACP Climate Justice Initiative, and Brenton Mock, a Washington-based DC journalist who writes regularly for Grist on environmental justice issues. Number here is 410-319-8888. There are a number of places I want to go here with this conversation, but let me ask you this question. I think that when I look at struggles taking place around environmental issues, especially in communities of color, which is where who are the people who now mainly populate places where pollution exists and the industry that builds it. Part of the problem has to do with the battle over jobs versus the future of the planet and the future of community. I can name a dozen places in America right now, including here in Baltimore, where people want to build incinerators and want to build other kind of plants that are going to pollute the air, hurt our children, hurt the land and the earth. But it's jobs, and people need jobs that pay a decent wage. And it seems that, Jacqueline Patterson, this is one of the things that is often a dividing line, and has been a dividing line between unions and people who are thinking about the environment and regular people caught right in the middle.
Yes. So that is, unfortunately, to some extent, it is a false dividing line in that there doesn't have to be a jobs versus health separation, health and well-being separation, in that there are jobs that are created through clean energy and advancing clean energy and energy efficiency, whether it's jobs in retrofitting and weatherization, jobs installing solar panels and maintaining the clean energy technology infrastructure. And then there's also a myriad other jobs, unfortunately, as we see these impacts of climate change, whether it's stormwater management jobs, jobs in disaster management, et cetera, jobs are being created as we move towards sustainability. We also really want to look at strengthening local economies. When we look at the jobs that are existing in, whether it's coal-fired power plants or incinerators, it tends to be very centralized. Like there's a big coal-fired power plant in one place that supplies all these different places and pollutes those places at the same time. And then there's a few jobs in that coal plant versus if we actually look at building local economies, then we have smaller kind of microgrids in different places and jobs associated with each of those microgrids. Also, even when we talk about our food system, and that's looking at both the one side in terms of driving climate change with the amount of movement that needs to happen for our food system now, trucks that move things and so forth. If we're really building local economies and having more farm-to-table where we actually are growing our food locally and putting it on our table locally, we actually can generate local jobs and reduce our emissions. So the examples are many, but it is a false separation. One thing I do want to acknowledge, because we don't want to kind of sound utopian and not acknowledge the reality, is that jobs are changing, obviously.
Right.
So someone who's worked in a coal-fired power plant for years and years would, if we're shutting down a coal-fired power plant, then yes, that person would not have that job. And that person might be trained to do that job and might not necessarily want to install solar panels or grow a garden in his backyard or whatever. So we definitely acknowledge that there is that issue that we need to grapple with. But in the long run, everyone, we really are concentrating on a just transition so that we're not just putting people out of jobs, but we're in real dialogue with labor and so forth so that it is a just transition for workers and communities.
I wonder, you know, as you do this reporting and work around the country, Brenton Mock, and looking at what's going on, I mean, where are people rising up around environmental justice that we're not seeing? Because I think this is not covered by the establishment press very much. And people often in their own communities feel disconnected from the other because
it's happening right there in Baltimore.
But, at the incinerator.
Yeah, the incinerator. I mean, this is a movement that's mainly led by kids.
Right, right? In Curtis Bay.
Right, the Free Your Voice, the high school students there have been fighting against the creation of a incinerator right there in, East Baltimore or South Baltimore?
It's right on the waters in Curtis Bay, which is
Curtis Bay, right.
Just below the city of Baltimore, yep.
Yeah,
yep.
And so just last week, the Attorney General sent I guess it wasn't a cease and desist order, but they told the company that they had to stop construction because they violated the offsets agreement that they were supposed to abide by. And so, that's an environmental justice victory that you can chalk up to, the youth
right
there. I mean, they did years of research on incinerators, the impacts that it would have on their communities, on their schools. They even did the research on which city entities had bought into the incinerator. That's how they found out that their own school district.
And got the school district to back away from it.
I don't know if they got the district to back away from. If they did, then you have more knowledge than I do. But I know that they do have the school district at least rethinking.
Right. Let me say that's probably more correct. Correct. Yes.
Yeah, and they invited the board members to come visit the community where the incinerator would go. I visited the community and went with the students around the neighborhood and saw as they organized their neighbors, spoke to the people about what was about to happen. So, these things are happening all the time. In Chicago, you have the Little Village Environmental Justice Group that literally shut down a coal-fired plant that had been raining pollution on Latino community out there for years, and the leader of that just won the Goldman Prize. Not this year, but last year, I believe. So, yeah, there's plenty of examples.
So, in the few minutes we have left in this particular segment, I wonder what you both think it means for the changing nature of and leadership within the environmental movement in the United States. Given that you, one of the things I read, and Marina Fang had this interesting piece in thinkprogress.org, where she just laid out how 60.3% of Latinos believe that humans contribute to climate change, compared to 67% of African Americans and almost 70% of Asian Americans, and only 56.7% of Caucasian Americans. So, I mean, which is interesting to me to see. So, what do you think this portends for the future? I'll start with Jackie and then end with Brenton.
So, what does that portend? I think, A, it portends that it makes it clear that that these communities are really on the front lines of the very same facilities and practices that drive climate change. So it makes sense that they would actually see that relationship. At the same time, I think that we are seeing already the increase and so as a result, we're seeing a lot of activism among those communities, and hopefully more. I think as we also see the impacts of climate change becoming clearer, we're seeing more broader public understanding as more people become directly impacted and see how it's affecting their lives. I think that's the trajectory we're on, and I think it's unfortunately going to get worse before it gets better, because we as a society do tend to be more reactive than proactive. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I see as it stands. But I think it is going to get better, because I think people are going to wake up and see. And I think that the organizing that's going on now, the place-based work that's going on now in terms of communities building local economies and really recognizing the need to have sustainable practices is happening, and it's scaling. But I do think it's going to get a little bit worse before it gets better. So.
As always is the case, it seems. Brenton Mock, your final thought on that, where you think this is going to take us?
Yeah, I mean, and just on that note, you know, I get press releases almost every day about how, you know, 90 supermajorities of African Americans support action on climate change. Supermajorities of Latinos support action on climate change. And quite frankly, I mean, I'm getting kind of sick of them. I mean, clearly we're not the problem, right? Like, clearly it's white people. Because when you compare the numbers, they're the ones that are always a little bit lacking, especially in terms of skepticism. I'm waiting for the press release that says, you know, 40% of white people still don't believe that climate change is a thing. Because that to me is the real news, and it seems to me that they're the ones that, you know, that really need to kind of bring their act together on this. But, I mean, you know, African Americans, Latinos, we've been talking about this. I mean, I just wrote a piece on Grist yesterday on the 25th anniversary of Spike Lee's movie Do the Right Thing. They were talking about the melting of polar caps in that movie. That movie came out in 1989. That was before Inconvenient Truth. You know, that movie, that was a movie primarily about urban heat islands and what happens, which is one of the most lethal killers under climate change. And so, you know, this is not a foreign issue to us. Not in the United States, definitely not in the global, you know, the global South. It's just a matter of, you know, perhaps finally, like, letting the people in these communities who've already been aware of climate pollution finally leading in the solutions.
Well, I want to thank you both so much, and look forward to having you both back a great deal, as we really do a lot of focus here on this program with activists and thinkers around the issue of environmental justice and how these movements are connected in America. Brenton Mock, Washington, D.C.-based journalist, writes regularly for The Grist about environmental justice issues and connections between environmental policy, race, and politics, and Jacqueline Patterson, who is director of the NAACP Climate Justice Initiative. Thank you both so much for taking your time here on The Mark Steiner Show and Soundbites today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you all. And now I remind you, last year something interesting happened here on the program. My producers went gleaning with Arthur Morgan, who was a 2012 OSI Baltimore Community Fellow and founder of Gather Baltimore. For those of you who aren't familiar with the term gleaning, it's the process of collecting leftover crops. Arthur does this in a few different ways. He gets leftover unsold produce at Baltimore farmers markets. He takes groups of volunteers to farms around the area to pick through the fields that have already been harvested. And the result is literally tons and tons, I mean tons and tons of food that Arthur distributes to those who need it through a community farm stands and other organizations. And here's the piece that my producers produced from last year before we meet Arthur Morgan.
Where are we right now? We are at George Zaraka, Zaraka Farms, down in Essex, off of 702. And what do you tell the volunteers when they get here? Pretty much just try and get everybody to work at their own pace. You know, just take their time, enjoy it. Everybody who comes and shows up and works, usually at the end of the day, about 15 to 30 minutes, we'll let everybody go and pick some food for themselves. So if you come and work, you can get some food. You know, we're just trying to let them know what's going on, too, and let them know that all this farmland is so close to the city. Because basically a lot of people come out here, they have no idea that all this is here. You know, they're used to the inner city harbor, and 15 minutes down the road, you're in the middle of nothing. And we're right by the water. You know, it's really pretty out here. You know, looking at 100 acres right here, just peppers and squash, eggplant. So it's a lot of food. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the third time we've been in this field in the last 3 weeks, and there's still tons of food. So, yeah, so we got eggplant over there, we got peppers, we got Brussels sprouts, collards, kale, chard. I mean, just tons of food. Got Movable Feast is here. I think the University of Baltimore's come in. And then we'll have volunteers from just about everywhere kind of hanging out and stuff. And then we'll take all the food and we'll go to... Y'all still haven't been to the Oliver Farms then, have you? So we're doing 200 to 500 families every Sunday. And what we do is usually do like a big IKEA bag and do $6 for the bag. And then if you bring the bag back every week, it'll be $5. You're looking at 30 to 40 pounds of food. Figure enough food for a family of four for a week. And basically the $5 or $6 just covers fuel. Got to pay for insurance. We've got to get new refrigeration units on that truck. $12,000 for just the little unit that sits up there. And the other unit on the other truck is already not working. So that's a bigger truck. That's $15,000. You know, we're just trying to get healthy food to people. 4 weeks ago, we had 500. So it was down a block, and then it turned and went down a block, and then turned and went down a block. But we're averaging around 200 to 250, and then we make another 50 to 60 bags that we deliver door-to-door to, like, homebound people. And then we probably have another 50 that there's people that just can't even afford the $5 to $6, and, you know, we try and make bags for those people, too. Tomorrow's going to be our first day where we're going to do two stands. So after the Oliver Farm stand, we're going to go over to Penn Lucy and do another probably 200 over there. But that's going to be our first day of two farm stands in one day. So we'll start at 12 o'clock. We'll be at the Baltimore Farmers Market, you know, getting all the food from there. And then we will go to the Oliver Farm stand at 1:30, go there to about 3, and then 3:30 pack up and head over to Penn Lucy and start that at 4. Obviously, there's a demand for healthy food everywhere in the city. Our goal is to have 5 farm stands within the next year in different neighborhoods. But then bigger part of the goal is to let the neighborhoods take over the farm stands. Like, we don't want to come in and do everything. We want to, you know, get the food to the people, but let the people in the neighborhoods run the stands, you know, decide, you know, who really needs the food and kind of let them manage everything.
George Zaraka, Zaraka Farm.
And I'm Hannah Mass with Movable Feast.
And this is your farm. What all do you grow out here?
All vegetables from asparagus to zucchini, basically, you know, and everything in between, basically.
How did you get connected with Arthur?
Arthur was, you know, we would donate whatever we had left over at the farmer's market, and then, we got hooked up this way. You know, like, last night we had a frost, so this is no, after tonight it's going to be done, so why not get it all out of here, you know.
Which farmer's markets do you go to?
We do a bunch, actually, but the one I hooked up with Arthur was under the Jones Falls.
What is the benefit to you to having people come out here and going through your field and gleaning?
It's just not a waste. You know, I mean, you don't see a bunch, you know, when I hook the mower up, mow these things off, it's like you look behind the mower and it's like millions of peppers laying in the field. And it's like, that's good. You know, there's nothing wrong with them. Just, they're just smaller. They're not grade A. You can't sell them at a grocery store or even at a farmer's market. They wouldn't buy them, you know, but they're fine to eat and there's nothing wrong with them. Why not give them to somebody? I don't have the time to pick them, so we get you guys out here to pick them, you know.
And how did you hook up with Gather Baltimore?
I think originally we started partnering in December 2012, so it's been almost a year. And I think we first connected through a program called GiveCorps, which does fundraising on behalf of like nonprofits and local startups. So first learned about them through that.
And what is Movable Feast?
Movable Feast, we're a local nonprofit in East Baltimore, and for about 24 years we've been in the community delivering healthy, nutritious meals to people in Maryland struggling with life-threatening conditions like AIDS and cancer. We're based in Baltimore City, and we now deliver to 14 counties in Maryland.
Are you all distributing some of the food that you're gathering here?
In the past, we have been recipients of produce that's been donated from this farm and other farms. And one thing that we do is we'll either incorporate it into the healthy meals we're making, or on a weekly basis, we deliver a bag of fruits and vegetables along with the meals that we provide. So we'll add it to that bag.
The biggest thing we want to let people know is that we're always looking for volunteers. We're looking for more places to take the food and places to set the farm stands and communities where we can partner with. But we need people to, you know, obviously we're funding this issue. So we have a Give Core campaign going on. We want people to go to Facebook and do Gather Baltimore, and that seems to be the best way to stay in contact. GatherBaltimore@gmail.com and GatherBaltimore.org is a good way to contact us. And same thing, we can't do anything without the volunteers. We can't do anything without the farmers. We can't do anything without the people who need the food. So it's just it's a large group of people working together. So just want to let everybody know thanks.
Now we have the man himself in the studio, Arthur Morgan, founder of Gather Baltimore, a volunteer-based group, as we've been hearing, that collects and greens fresh produce donated by farmers markets and farms for distribution here in Baltimore City. Good to see you, man.
Hey, how are you doing today, sir?
I'm good. So, you know, it is strange. I mean, the people don't think about this whole notion of gleaning, the idea of actually going out to farmers' fields and the places and taking what
getting,
is that? Yeah.
I remember
the last time we did a town meeting, you were there. You came to the town meeting that we did, and you said, "I have cantaloupes." I'm thinking, he's got cantaloupes. He said, "No, if you take a slab, we've got tons, yeah. tons of cantaloupes. That's a lot of cantaloupes."
Last week, they called me, and I had 17 pallets of cantaloupes that were just left over that they said, "Come and get. You know, we've got to make room." And instead of actually being overripe, they were underripe, so they even had more time on them. So they were saying, "Hey, just get them because we've got to make room." So it was actually
they would have been thrown out otherwise.
They would have thrown them right away. So just to make room for the next stuff. So
literally, what you're doing is taking food that would rot into the fields, of food that would be thrown out of markets, and that is really good edible food.
Yes,
and you're giving the people for low price or free who really need the food in our
communities.
Absolutely,
we have to. You know, our model is sustainable now, so we do ask for a small donation that, you know, covers basic costs as far as like fuel, insurance, things like that. But our goal is to make healthy local food affordable to those that just don't have access to it. And there is so much of that food everywhere. And it's I say the same thing where it's for sale at $11.59, but at $12 they don't want to load it on the truck. They don't want to take it back. So it's very high quality food. And then the food that's in the fields, it is even, you know, better because it hasn't even been picked yet. But, you know, you got to make room for,
It makes you realize, though, that we could probably feed.
Yes.
People probably could consume the food they need in our communities just by the food that we waste.
Exactly.
It's not like saying you need to go to the dump and have the waste. It's not waste food. That's food that any of us, everybody would eat, but it's just thrown out because they can't get to it.
And that's it. It's just the language we choose to use can kind of, you know, we need to be careful that way because people will look at things differently. But that's why now we're just saying that we are creating farm stands. And all we're doing is just taking food that was at one spot and taking it to another spot and going into neighborhoods where a lot of people would not necessarily go and set up a farm stand or a farmer's market. So we're going into those areas where people just don't have access. But this is really, really good, healthy food that a lot of people aren't used to seeing or, you know, have never had before. But there's a tremendous amount of food that's just, it's going to waste. And people deserve healthy food, and it needs to be affordable. Farmers need to be compensated also, though. I mean, it's very hard work. And
it's hard work to glean the fields.
It is. You
have volunteers with you to help pick the vegetables that are being left there.
That's the biggest thing, and I'll get to it, you know, as quick as I can. Volunteers. You know, Facebook, Gather Baltimore. We depend so heavily on volunteers who want to come out and either just help us for the day, or a lot of organizations we want to partner with that might be a church or some type of kitchen or something, where if they come and help us, then we can take some of that food back to their organization and help serve their groups. So we definitely depend on volunteers. We do have people that are getting paid now. We are generating a small amount of money to where we can pay some people to help. We would love to be able to grow, and that's actually what's going on now. We're growing so fast that it's hard to keep up because there is just so much food. But, you know, we need to raise funds so that we could have a warehouse, refrigeration, transportation of that food. But right now, if I had the space, I've got the food. Food's not the problem. That's not the problem. Now is just manpower and space.
Space to store the food.
Space to store the food.
Refrigerated place to still.
Yes, sir.
Because you have stands like at Oliver Street where you stand, where your food stand is, and other places like that.
Yep. Right? And we're doing Pin Lucy. We've done a couple other stands where we're partnering with different groups, and even doing a couple on Saturdays now where we'll just Oliver is every week. Pin Lucy is every second and fourth Sunday. But now we're going to start doing some Saturday markets, even if it's just, you know, once a month, but that way we can get into those neighborhoods and let people know that food is available, and then hopefully we can partner with those groups, and they can help us glean. You know, they can help us go get the food, because that's a big part of what we're doing. Also, is working with these community organizations who will identify people in their neighborhood, set up these stands, run the stands.
Yep.
It's just a matter of being respectful, too, of the neighborhoods you're going into. You know, we don't want to just come in when it's convenient for us and be there once a year. You know, they need to be able to depend on us, and we need to be able to depend on them. You know, if we spend all week getting this food, you know, we need to know that we can count on each other.
So one of the things, you've been on the show numerous times, and I'm glad you're on the show because we want to get this out there.
I appreciate it.
But one of the reasons you're here today is because when you talk about the need for refrigeration and storage facilities,
yes,
you're actually having a fundraiser coming up this week. Is it this weekend?
Monday.
Monday.
The 7th. July 7th. We're going to be at Clementine's, 5 to 10. We're doing our spaghetti dinner. Clementine's is always really good to us, you know, usually once or twice
a year.
That's
on Hartford Road.
Hartford Road, yep, 5 to 10. We're going to be having a spaghetti dinner, and the funds from that dinner are actually going to go towards purchasing a freezer. Because now also, when you have so much food that's abundant certain parts of the year, we need to get that and freeze it. Not just keep it cool and store it, but if we can actually freeze it, you know, then come January, February, March, you'll have all of that, those tomatoes and peppers, all those things that you aren't going to have because there's going to be 4 foot of snow on the ground. And there's that much food to get. So now we are growing.
Wow.
You know, we've gone from just regular refrigeration space to where you get it and store it, hold it for a couple of days, to where, you know, 10, 20, 30,000 pounds. Also working with groups that can help us process this stuff, so we can actually work with culinary training programs, students, kids, people looking for jobs. You know, take the food to them. They use the food to train their people, and then they give us back a value-added product. So there's partnerships that work that way also. But, yeah, Clementine's Monday night, spaghetti dinner.
How do you get the information for tickets?
Go on our webpage, gatherbaltimore.org.
Gatherbaltimore.org.
Please go to Facebook. You can see Gather Baltimore Facebook. We still have our GiveCore campaign. We always keep a GiveCore campaign going year-round. Facebook is the best way because that'll let you know what's going on. We are absolutely looking for groups as we speak to partner with that can help us start gleaning. We're going to be gleaning within the next couple of weeks. We go to One Straw Farms, the Rocka Farm, Richards. We're going to start doing partnering them with the USDA in Beltsville.
Some of these organic food you're talking about.
This is incredibly healthy, good food. Acres and acres of healthy food. But we need bodies.
So, again, how do people get to this dinner Monday night?
Monday night, Clementine's, 5 to 10.
And Clementine's is the address is?
Hartford Road. You can also go to Facebook and gatherbaltimore.org.
And go there. Support GatherBaltimore.org. This is a place. We'll have it on our webpage. All the information will be there at SteinerShow.org, too. We'll put it up there under our Soundbites project for today. And supporting Arthur Morgan's work of Gather Baltimore. It's not just feeding a lot of people in Baltimore. It's getting people involved in their own food in Baltimore and building a whole community around healthy food in our neighborhoods. And
For everyone.
So Arthur Morgan, thanks so much for your work. Founder of Gather Baltimore, and go to GatherBaltimore.org.
Facebook,
and get your tickets and come on over. Have some spaghetti Monday night at 7.
Yep, 5 to 10
5 to 10.
The 7th, July 7th.
So anytime that fits you, 5 to 10. Arthur, thanks so much.
Brother. Thank you very much.
Good to have you here.
Thanks, sir.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineers, Andrew Melton. Our interns are Sienna Greaves and Sam Saper and Matt Malice and Alec Boston. You can hear the show again, podcast our past shows, and also get information about all our guests and what they've been talking about by visiting us at SteinerShow.org. You can also listen to and download all of our podcasts on iTunes. We're going out with Rockin' Robin. It's the birthday of Bobby Day, the man who made this incredible song. Bob and Earl did this. And for Public Radio, WEAA, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. Sing and go, bird, go, rock and robin, rock and robin, go, rock and robin, 'cause we're really gonna.